Hey guys, welcome to the show. This is going to be a podcast in a series of podcasts where we talk about transport ventilators. Some of the questions that we're going to try to cover today is, how would I know that my ventilator settings will meet my patient's needs? We'll also try to answer the question, is the proper setting or the proper mode to transport your patient as well? And then we're also going to cover, can you or should you try to match the hospital settings? We're going to try to cover those three questions, but first and foremost, before we really get started, we wanted to talk about ventilator technology and the advancement of where the transport ventilator has been to where it's going. So I kind of want to shift the conversation over to our resident respiratory therapist, Michael Shaw, and let him talk about the advancement of transport ventilators, where they were at, and where they're going. So, Michael, I'll turn the question and the conversation over to you.
Thanks, Jerome. Yeah, I started using transport ventilators in 1994, and they have come a long way. I like to categorize the ventilators in three different types: mass casualty ventilators, pre-hospital ventilators, and then inter-facility ventilators. Each one has a specific designed to work specifically for that arena. When I first started, the technology was what it was. It was all we had. I just want to show you one of the vents that I pulled out of my archives. This is the Univent by Impact. And just to give you an idea, it was strictly a volume ventilator. This knob right here, you dialed the flow in, and by the eye time, it decided what the tidal volume was. So you didn't even have a tidal volume dial on this thing. It was a flow and eye time. As we know, that's how we get tidal volume, right? So you also needed a blender, an external blender, for medical air and oxygen to get a certain percentage of FiO2. It was either 100% or 20%, right? So that said, we've come a long way. Now we have pressure ventilators, volume ventilators. I look for the advancement of synchrony with the patient, right? So these older ventilators have this pressure sensor. When the patient takes a breath in, the pressure is triggered and it'll trigger a breath. There's a big delay there. Now we have flow sensors and all this high technology stuff. So one of the reasons, somebody might choose a ventilator today through the technology, because they can get pretty expensive, right? So you want to make sure that you want to match the ventilator for your demographics. But what's your patient population? Do I need a high-end, sophisticated ventilator if I'm just doing 911 calls? Well, that's up to you. But that's one of the demographics is probably the number one reason. Also, simplicity. Some of these ventilators are a little difficult to run. Some of them are very simple to run. That's something that people take into consideration. What are the modes available? Are they the modes that are being used in the hospital today? If you're going to do interfacility transports, you want to make sure your vent does pretty much the same as the hospital vent as far as modes go. What is the cost? That's usually the number one deciding factor as to which reason an organization would buy a vent, right? The bean counters look at the numbers and they say, why do we need a $25,000 vent? We can get one for $2,000, right? The other thing that's important to me is the feedback from that ventilator. Am I getting monitored values that are important to me, like auto-PEEP, plateau pressures? Those are things that you want to take into consideration when you're transporting some high acuity patients. Also, recently you see a lot of patients that are needing BiPAP, non-invasive ventilation. Can my ventilator support BiPAP? Does it have enough flow available to it? Right. You see a lot of patients not being intubated for ground and flight transports that do very well on BiPAP, but some of the machines may not be able to do that job, right? And then with the advent of COVID-19 coming on, a lot of people are saying, well, I want to transport my patient on high-flow nasal cannula. And some vents do that, right? Aside from the oxygen limitations that we have in the aircraft or the truck, some people still want to do high-flow, and some vents do that. So those are some of the reasons. Service support, reliability, and battery life are some of the other reasons we search for certain, in particular, transport ventilators.
You know, and I think that brings to point something that just comes to mind, just from a paramedic's point of view, especially, is that simplicity. And I'm not saying that just because, you know, paramedics can't operate something sophisticated. I'm not saying that at all. What I am saying is when you have a million different things going on in the back of that truck, can you do what needs to be done, and is it going to be easy enough to do to be able to stay on top of what's going on with your patient? Simplicity, can it do what it needs to do? How is it going to function in the back of that truck as well, even in the back of an aircraft? You know, I think that kind of goes into, everything that you mentioned. Caleb, as far as being a nurse, and, you know, all three of us have flight transport experience and also ground transport experience with what we've done before. What would you say would be some of the things that you would look at as well?
Yeah, the first thing is the data. Data drives everything in our industry now. So you have all kinds of EPCRs that's available for you. So what's your patient transport population? Why do I need this vent? To Shaw's point, what he was talking about was matching the vent to what you're actually going to need. It's great to have all the bells and the whistles on some of these ventilators, but do you really need them? And what is my market? What am I trying to meet the demands for? In the critical care world, then yes, we do. It's interesting that, you know, that we can get a chance to look at some of these ventilators and see all the technological breakthroughs that they've had. You know, we can monitor different parameters, even loop patterns and stuff now that we can actually start to see. But also understanding, too, that there comes a teaching component within the nurses and the paramedics world is, yes, these ventilators can do this, but now I have to make sure that my education platforms are actually meeting the educational demands for what I'm trying to transport in the first place. So I think that's an interesting standpoint. And then, again, looking at your data, just trying to see, do I need it mainly for what's my population, pediatrics, adults, high-risk OBs? There's a lot of different special population sets that we can actually use it for. So I think that's the biggest things of trying to look at when we're moving into selecting a ventilator, and also trying to see how do we actually get it onto the truck. Another thing that we're looking at too, like to Shaw's point, with the high flow nasal cannula and the BiPAP, oxygen consumption is a huge challenge in the transport industry. Huge, huge. So, I mean, you have to look at what's my consumption rates. Can I even meet some of these patient transport demands, or am I going to have to maybe look at other means of trying to maybe transport this patient? So I think some of those that we can talk about a little bit later on, but those are interesting points that you can look at before you even select a ventilator.
You know, and what you just brought up, that kind of brings to point one of the first questions that we're going to try to ask as well when we start talking about ventilators is, and I kind of want to ease towards Shaw as well, is how would I know that my ventilator settings will meet my patient's needs? Because that right there in selecting a ventilator, I know that's going to be paramount in selecting one, making sure that it's going to meet it. But after we obtain that ventilator, how are we going to know that it's going to meet what our patient needs?
An excellent question, Jerome. I can't stress enough that when you are tasked to manage a patient on a mechanical ventilator, that you need to know that machine like the engineers that built it. You really need to dig into that manual. You need to play with it on test lungs to see its capabilities. There's pneumatic ventilators, there's piston-driven ventilators, and there's turbine blower-driven ventilators. And each have different characteristics. So how do I know? I really don't know. I need to know more about the patient. We're not ventilating a test lung when we go to the bedside, right? It's a live patient that we don't know if they have...
Absolutely.
We don't know if they have a normal lung function, or if they have an obstructive or a restrictive process. So, and those are treated two different ways. So it gets back to knowing your equipment and knowing your patient
And for the most part, I've run into situations where the equipment that I have had cannot adequately support the mission for that particular patient. And that's just been the case. Not very often, because typically you'll get on report something that looks like you'll be able to do when you get to bedside. And to confirm it, you would just go ahead and put the patient on it with the hospital ventilator on standby and get some readings, some monitor value readings of how it's functioning for peak inspiratory pressures and for end-tidal CO2 and oxygenation. So oxygenation ventilation, is it able to support that patient safe and comfortable manner for the patient? You don't want to have to right away the first thing heavily sedate the patient. You want to tune up that vent. So it's a tough question to answer. On a test lung, you know it's going to work, right? But on a live patient, it's a little bit different.
So what you're saying is that if we do, let's say, for example, I'm a new guy, I just walk in the door, it's probably not best practice to put me in that transport vehicle with that ventilator that I've never touched before or only had maybe a five-minute crash course.
Does that happen? I mean, does that happen?
Never. Here's the on switch. Here's the silence button.
Absolutely. I think, you know, I wanted to bring that out because there's been a few places in my career way back in the day where, you know, great, you're a paramedic, great, go. Here's your stuff, do what you need to do. I guess the next question is, it kind of goes into, and I kind of want to tag on the back side of this, is so really after we get our ventilator, we are properly trained, emphasis quote, proper. What do you suggest is the best mode to transport my patient on that ventilator? I understand we need to know a few things about them, but let's say what would be the best mode? And I kind of want Shoff's opinion and I want Caleb's opinion as well. I think I'm going to kind of tag in as well. But what would be your opinion, Shoff, on the best mode to transport my patient on a ventilator?
Okay, so just to be clear, there are 174 plus names of modes out in the industry today. Probably 180. Very confusing. I don't believe there's one magic mode for every patient. I think that's impossible. I tend to go on a case-by-case basis for each patient that I'm preparing to transport. The most common mode for transport and the most common modes that I'm aware of on transport ventilators are assist control with a volume or a pressure target, and SIMV, synchronized intermittent mandatory ventilation, in a volume or pressure target with an added pressure support breath for that spontaneous breath. Now, there's a lot of different schools of thought, which is why people like to use those, and I really will get into a modes podcast down the road because that opens up a can of worms, and I don't want to do that right now.
Are you speaking about me?
I am. Not just you. There's probably you know, out there. But I have my I'm a big fan of I found that volume target is probably the number one way I would set a machine because I'm guaranteed a minute volume at that point. I am at heart a cowboy and I love pressure control. I think pressure control is a better delivered breath for the patient. It's a decelerating flow and it can be more comfortable, especially for the air hungry patient and the sick patient, the one that has ARDS. But there's a lot of different schools of thought, and studies have not shown either way which is better. But I you know, we'll get into that more. Again, case by case, what is the patient on? What do they need? How do I think he'll do? The main thing I need to consider when we talk about modes or anything with the patient is I'm taking that patient out of a very stable environment, a nice comfortable bed, they're watching TV, whatever it is, and I'm throwing them on a stretcher, and I'm throwing them in the back of a bus, into a rotorcraft, a fixed wing. I'm changing their environment, so I need to pay attention to how that change in the environment is going to affect the mode they're in, right? So plan B and plan C. So there is no one magic mode, that's all I got to say.
Right.
Okay, what do you think about that? And I know that you are agreeing with him there. What's your thoughts on that?
So I, like Shoff, I'm kind of like in one of these areas too. There's no magic mode. I mean, I think you have to just meet your patient's demands, which is, you know, back to the first question of looking at how do I know that the ventilator settings will meet my patient's needs? So that's knowing your equipment, making sure that you know your equipment and the limitations of your equipment as well. Taking these patients out of a stable environment, you need to, in my view, you need to have a chance at bedside to take a 5 or 10 minute pause to try to see how the patient is going to adapt to that ventilator, into those ventilator settings. Because like Shaw, I liked doing more of a pressure type of mode too as well, but I also understand that there's different settings that I'm going to have to change. And like we said, we're going to get into the mode sections a little bit more. But when you start trying to look at if there's a specific mode, a recommended mode for transport, it depends on the ventilator. It also depends on the patient. It depends on the pathophysiology that's going on with the patient, too. There's a lot of different parameters here that we can actually talk about, which is great that we're getting a chance to kind of do this ventilator series, because that was one of my drawbacks when I worked as a paramedic and then transitioned into the nurse. And then transitioned into the ICU world. I got to look from different views before I actually started flying. Not everybody gets that view. Most people will just either start off flying, they get their 3 or 4 years as a paramedic or as a nurse, and then they'll actually start flying. One of the things that I wanted to do was to make sure, and I had a respiratory friend, you know, kind of like how introverts and extroverts have their people and stuff too. Well, maybe an introvert would always have to have an extrovert drum, you know, like this, because you're the extrovert and you just tag me along for the conversation. So like with my respiratory therapist over here, what I would do is I would tag along with the respiratory therapist and I would annoy them to the point to where they would answer my questions about this ventilator and their ways of thinking. And so that's what I wanted to see before I started flying, and also before, you know, I still get to bedside and I want to have a conversation with them and make sure that they're in the room, because you get so much more out of the respiratory therapist at bedside by talking to them, because it's just two different levels of thinking, you know. So to me, is matching up those settings, but also trying to understand what's also going on with the patient, what have they tried and stuff so far, because knowing the differences of that transport ventilator, and it's challenging. It can be very challenging. You know, like you said to the point earlier and stuff, you've got the beam counters that's going to give you something over here, and they could limit this, and I understand. You know, not everybody needs all the bells and whistles on an expensive ventilator. So you're going to have to need to know what is going to match the patient the best, I think.
Yeah. And well, you know, with Shoff talking about, you know, him being volume on some patients and he likes pressure, and then you go into pressure. I can't say whether I'm a volume or a pressure guy, because, and I think it could be the way that I did learn the ventilator. The way that I looked at it was, is because I was that guy that I worked for several years on the ground and worked in different states just to the north of where I live. And then I got the experience being on the aircraft, and that's when I got more experience with a ventilator. So I had to learn it a totally different way. So, you know, the way that, you know, Shaw thinks being a respiratory therapist, and the way that you think being a nurse medic working in ICU and the ER and different things like that, critical care transport, I didn't get the exposure. I transported a ventilator a few times, and most of it was a home ventilator. So I look at it a different way. So I thought that was, it's really interesting, the different schools of thought and the way that they kind of mesh here, and the way we're looking at it. And Caleb, you brought up a good point as far as, you know, matching and different things. And I'm going to kind of ask you to kind of unpack that a little bit on what you think. And then I'm going to kind of back it up with Shoff as well. As, do you think that we should try to match the hospital settings when we are leaving there, or what should we be doing?
Agree. So this group has been together. Me, you, and Michael have actually been together for a while, and we've had a chance to explore a lot of different ventilators and even do some ventilator tests and trial some other type of ventilators. And knowing what I know now, I would say that you have to be very careful with matching the hospital settings. First, you, to Shaw's point, you have to know whether it's pneumatically driven, whether it's a piston-driven ventilator, or whether it's a turbine-driven ventilator, which is huge in the transport world. If you understand the limitations of a piston-driven ventilator and you're coming from a turbine-driven ventilator that's in the hospitals, it's totally different. So trying to meet those minute volume demands for the patient, especially with some type of BiPAP patient, bi-level patients, or some types of pediatric patients that you're going to have to maybe be transporting. So the first things first is I want to know what type of hospital settings that they're on, how did we get here, and what's wrong with the patient? How long has the patient been where they are presently? It's going to determine the fact of whether the patient's in the ER setting or whether the patient's been in the ICU setting, which is totally different, totally different worlds. And having worked, getting a chance to work in both of those worlds, I can honestly say it's just a totally different way of thinking. It's almost like when you come from a paramedic into a nurse, it's different ways of thinking as well. Well, within the nursing spectrum, you also have different ways of thinking from the ER standpoint to a ICU standpoint. And the ventilators, Shaw, correct me if I'm wrong, but the ventilators predominantly in the ER versus the ICU, they can be very different too, depending on what type of the patient's actually going on, how long that they've actually been there, and where we're taking the patient. So again, with the hospital settings, I want to start looking at a lot more things, and we can unpack this on some of the other podcasts and stuff that we're actually doing for a little bit later on with the lab settings, with the modes, how did they get to this point, x-rays, the physiology, that stuff. But those are some very basic generic questions and thinkings that I'm thinking about when I get to bedside is to trying to see how best to meet this patient's demands. I don't know, Shaw, what do you think?
I agree with everything you said. I make a living of oxygenating and ventilating patients on ventilators, and I love it. It's an awesome job. And the only way I confirm I'm doing that is to see an arterial blood gas. That's the gold standard. We rely on non-invasive, the pulse oximeter and the end-tidal CO2, but I need an ABG. I also need an X-ray. So am I going to match the exact settings? Yeah, I want to start around there. First of all, I want to make sure that those settings they're on in the hospital are meeting the needs of the patient based on the arterial blood gas. Because you can have a PaCO2 of 67, right, and think that you may need to blow off the CO2, but the bicarb is 41 and the pH is 7.40, right? So let's treat the pH, don't treat the PaCO2. The patient compensated. Why do you want to increase the minute volume? That's ridiculous. So that's the first thing I check is the ABG. If I want to match the settings, I got to make sure they're on the right settings. And it has been my experience, you're not going to believe this, it has been my experience over the years that not every patient that I'm picking up are on the correct settings. It becomes my responsibility to make it notice that and recommend
correct settings. There's correct settings. What are you talking about?
And I base it on oxygenation and ventilation and the pH, right? So if I have that information, and by the way, a recent ABG, not one from 2 weeks ago.
Oh, absolutely.
That's so important. So important.
So a recent ABG and a recent chest x-ray, because I want to see number one where the ET tube is placed, 2 to 3 centimeters above the carina, and I want to look at the lung fields. Right? I want to see if there's any free air, there's any mucus, or whatever, an ARDS pattern, a COPD pattern, things like that. So to match the settings is okay, but what people fail to realize is a hospital ventilator, let's say they're about $30,000 to $40,000, they have a lot of bells and whistles, but the one thing they have that your vent, transport vent, may or may not have is the ability to adjust the flow. We don't ever talk about flow, but flow in my world is extremely important. Remember, I like to say that any ventilator is a flow generator that we target a volume or we target a pressure, we generate flow. And how we generate that flow is really important to how the patient feels, right? If they're awake, they're going to feel a difference no matter what settings you put the exact same settings in, the same eye time, everything. The flow is going to be different on the transport ventilator. I guarantee it. Now, the hospital ventilators have a lot of variety. You could put decelerating flow at different degrees of cutoff. You could have a sine wave, a square wave. There's a lot of different flows that you can taper for the patient's comfort. Now, over the years, the transport companies have realized that they do rise time or P ramp or things like that, that they can get that initial burst of flow and they can taper that, but not necessarily. If it's a square waveform, it's just going to be a square waveform. They can't do much. In pressure ventilation, we can taper the flow a little bit and fine-tune it. But the point is, I may match the patient's settings exactly, but it may not do the same job. You really have to.
Right.
Yeah.
You may need to, in a volume-targeted breath, on some ventilators, you may have to drop the eye time to deliver more flow. Because in a volume-targeted breath on some transport ventilators, the flow is fixed based on the volume and the eye time, like right. I mentioned earlier, right? So if they're air hungry, I might drop the eye time just a little bit within an adult range if it's an adult patient, or I might just switch over to pressure control because pressure control is going to give them that decelerating flow. It's going to give it in there really fast, and it works out better. So it's a yes and no answer. Do you match them? Yeah, you want to match the same settings, provided they're adequate with the ABG results, right? Oxygenation and ventilation. But you got to take the limitations, as Caleb mentioned, and you did too, Jerome, about the machine itself. Can it reach that flow? I've had patients that on piston-driven ventilators that did fantastic. 97% of my patients just great. But I get a patient with a PEEP of 12, a minute volume of 20, and a rate of, I don't know. I don't know how that's going to fare on this patient. Status asthmaticus is probably the worst, hardest, and severe ARDS, the hardest patients to ventilate on any ventilator, even the hospital ventilators. And now we're asking to do that transport ventilator. It's asking a lot. So,
well, you know, I think with that as well, I think a lot of these questions, and I hate to even say this word, I think COVID brought up a lot of things that they may have been thought about with ventilators. People may have been asking these questions, but I think these three questions probably came to the forefront, especially after COVID showed up and people started transporting these patients for longer distances because there were no hospital beds available or they needed to go somewhere else that could more adequately take care of them. And I feel like that those three questions probably stood out more so than anything as far as that goes. I guess with that, we've talked about, should you match or what do you suggest or what ventilator settings. And I guess one of the last questions that I would want to ask, and I feel like this has been asked me numerous times as well, is what questions should I be asking when I go in? I know that you guys have covered, why are we here? Why are we transporting this patient? What mode are they in? What has been done for this patient prior to me getting here and taking this patient out of your facility and putting them in my aircraft or in my ambulance or in my fixed wing as well? And, some of those questions. And what questions should we be asking, guys? And I'll let either one of you take up on this next question, but what questions should we be asking?
Michael, I'll let you go ahead, and then I can wrap up, and then we'll try to see where we go from there. If you want to take it, the first one.
Sure thing. When I come to bedside, I hope I have enough information to have a game plan in my head that I get, pre-arrival, which is rare, but sometimes we get that in the fixed-wing industry for sure. So I want to get to bedside and I want to talk to the nurse and I want to talk to the RT. And I want the ABG, the recent ABG and the recent chest x-ray. But I want to ask the nurse or the RT some questions. Why were they intubated? I have all that information, right? Do they have any lung disease? I want to know if they have any smoking history, emphysema. versus, let's say they have pneumonia, or let's say they have ARDS or something. Those are two different disease processes, restrictive and obstructive. I need to know they're treated differently. So those are some things that I'm thinking in the back of my head. Do they have asthma, any history of asthma? Do they have any cardiac issue? A lot of people overlook the cardiac issue. If I'm not perfusing and I have dead space ventilation, well, I can't expect good sats, right? I don't want to go up on the PEEP. If the patient has a cardiac issue and add more pressure to the inner thoracic cavity and hurting that cardiac output more, I may need to be comfortable with sats of 91, 92, right? There's questions I always have. Are they on breathing treatments? When was the last time they got one? 2 hours ago. Well, they're a little diminished and wheezing. But can we give them a PRN now at bedside on a nice little Arogen, drop some juice in a cup, hit a button, as opposed to me hooking it up into the ventilator circuit and adding more flow into that circuit? And, you know, I'd rather not do it on transport. Have you been suctioning the patient? How do they respond to suctioning? Do they vagal? How often do you go? What do you get? Thick, copious amounts of green, smelly stuff, right? Lung butter, right? How much lung butter are you getting out of there? Is there any infection brewing, right? Can I see the x-ray lids on pneumonia, right, low? That's going to cause, like, the shunt, right? So we're looking at some low sats, right, high oxygen. That means a lot to me when I'm bringing the patient. The other thing, that, especially more so in the fixed wing, is I want to look at whatever condition they're in and they have, how is a cabin altitude of 6,000 feet going to affect their lung physiology and the rest of it, right? Do they have any trapped air anywhere? Any cardiac issues, any kind of things that the higher altitude or cabin altitude is going to affect their oxygenation ventilation. And from there, I just do the basics. I look at the VT tube and make sure it's secure and, you know, the best I can do with that. And ask, you know, is the patient breathing spontaneously? All those extra questions. And, of course, you know, CBCs. And I don't have any hemoglobin, and I certainly don't have any oxygenation carrying capacity. Right. So those things come, right? Inhalation, perfusion. So that's about, I mean, I have many more, but I'm going to let Caleb go because I'm kind of out of breath.
So, yeah, again, looking at where the patient is, looking if they're on the ICU, the floor, or the ER. You know, sometimes we would get those random calls and stuff from the floors, especially during COVID, you know, because these would be sometimes your high flow nasal cannula patients or your BiPAP patients, right? So predominantly our world would actually intermingle between the ER world and ICU world. So if I'm in the ICU world, I want to see my trends. You know, that's the one thing that ICU actually taught me is I want to see trends, I want to see labs, I want to see recent x-rays, but I'm also looking for timestamps to make sure when these labs were actually taken, when the x-rays were actually done, and or if there's CTs or anything else, and to see how the patient's actually been trending. You know, Schauf calls it lung butter over there. We always called it pulmonary toilet patients to try to see, you know, are they circling the drain? Are they in the vortex? Are they coming down? Or are we trying to pull this patient back out? So that's one area of actually looking at it. From the ER standpoint is more along the lines that's probably a recent acute event that's actually going on. So now am I dealing with a patient who had some type of cardiac event, maybe some issue over there, maybe some traumatic events or something that's kind of led to this. And it's different ways of thinking, you know. So I've got to tailor the way that I'm approaching this patient to what has actually gone on with this patient at first. Michael has a chance to actually get a chance for these patients and transport them across long distances. In the rotor world, we maybe get these patients for 30 minutes, absolutely, sometimes shorter than that.
Absolutely.
So that's a big change for us in the rotor world. You get these patients for 30 minutes. So now then, am I patching this patient just to get to the next facility? Can I meet this patient's demands? Or what else can I actually do to impact this patient's care before I get over there to that patient? You know, I mean, we can, I know that we're coming up against our time today and stuff today with what we wanted to accomplish with the first one. And we can unpack those a little bit later on. But those are just some beginning thoughts of what we're looking at. Maybe it might even be great to actually have just a bedside report podcast or something like that. You can make a whole lot out of that, just trying to get the what you're interpreting there and the information that you actually want to get. So good thoughts, though. Very good thoughts.
Yeah, you know, and you know, kind of backing up what Schauf has said and what Caleb has said as well is, you know, being the paramedic, being on the ground, more or less you're thinking about here and now. You don't really have that, I guess, time period to think about them. You're thinking about what I have to do now to get them to where they're going. And I've heard a lot of, we've always heard the joke, but did you die? And they always go, well, they were alive when I dropped them off. And I think that's one mentality as far as paramedics need to go. And I've even heard it, you know, from different clinicians on both sides of the spectrum, is that I got them there alive. But I think we need to transition from thinking that get them there alive to what is their quality of life going to be when I get them there? What is going to happen to them after I leave? After I leave, after the report's done, after everything's done and I'm on another call, maybe even 2 or 3 days later. And I think those questions really bring to light that with the three of us being, you know, respiratory, nurse, and paramedic, I think that those bring more questions and it kind of brings more to the table as well. But I think, guys, I think we're probably at knocking on the door of the time that we wanted to cover today. And I really do appreciate the discussion. I feel like we could probably go on for hours, especially with bouncing things off of each other. I really do appreciate you guys. You guys are awesome. Thank you guys for coming in and talking. And we all three, I think we make a great team. So I think that we'll kind of call it quits for today. We hope to see you guys later. And until next time, when you come back for the next podcast in this series, we'll see you guys later.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, guys.
The information provided in this podcast is intended for educational and informational purposes only. It is not intended to be a substitute for medical direction or training. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and guest and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the organization or institution that they may represent. The listeners are advised that the information contained in this podcast should be used in conjunction with professional medical training and best practice guidelines. The host and guests of this podcast take no responsibility for the actions or decisions of the listeners.